shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I'm happy to be sitting in today with Loretta Frelick, a former criminal prosecutor for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, now retired. And we're happy to join you. We are in Holy Week. Any other year, this would be the Feast of the Annunciation, which is a terrific pro-life holiday when the Word became flesh, quite literally, and dwelt among us. And we're exactly 9 months from Christmas. So what that also means.
It doesn't mean start your shopping.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm okay. I'll admit this. I'm just finishing putting up my decorations. Or sorry, putting away my decorations. They somehow morphed and multiplied. You know, when I went to bed at night, it was like some freakish Toy Story thing, except with Christmas ornaments. And I am efforting to organize them better this year, and you know we're on the cusp now of being empty nesters, so I have to start giving some of these things away and putting aside childhood things, you know, childhood Christmas stuff. You're lucky because you have an alternative off-site to store your things. I do not.
Well,
so I don't have the luxury that you do.
Well,
so
I have been blessed.
Don't you look at me with that stink eye.
Yeah, but I'm learning this year, none of my decorations, so all my St. Patrick's Day decorations are at the beach house. I didn't have any St. Patrick's Day decorations, and I never made it up there. So I got to rethink it myself.
Yeah, you may need something closer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
I have a garage I'd rent out to you.
Okay.
For $1 million or else. You better be careful of your rental property because there's squatters now getting explicit instructions on how to squat in a house if it's not being occupied at
all
times.
I would pay that guy from Venezuela to put on there, but don't go near Loretta's house.
Right. That may actually get someone sent right to your house. But anyway, that is not the topic of our show today.
No.
So it is Holy Week. Your parish will be having Holy Week observations. I would suggest to you, if you have never been to a Spy Wednesday service for Tenebrae on Wednesday, it is probably one of the most emotionally stirring liturgical events you can attend all year long. It's once a year. St. John Cantius at on Chicago's Near North Side does a beautiful Tenebrae service that starts at 7 p.m. on Wednesday evening. It is likely your parish also has something similar, but if you've never been, I would highly, highly recommend it.
Yes.
And, of course, none of these days coming up are obligatory. And as my mother always used to say, though, that's because you shouldn't need to be told to go to church on Holy Thursday and Good Friday. But I read The Passion yesterday at my parish. I was I had the narrator role.
Very good.
And my husband was one of the voices. And we had a big turnout for Palm Sunday at my parish. How about yours? Was it
crowded? I was so impressed because the presider gave everyone the opportunity to be seated if they wished.
Oh.
And so more than those that sat down stood during the Passion.
Yeah.
As if that was just like a little sacrifice they could offer Jesus.
Yeah.
I am very excited because our Holy Thursday services at our parish are going to include three different age-appropriate adoration services.
Oh, good.
That I've been asked to lead for the children in our school, and I'm so excited.
Excellent. Oh, that's a nice idea.
So please say some prayers for me.
Yeah.
I really want them to fall in love with Jesus and make regular visits and be so confident in their relationship with him that they can go to the monstrance and pour out their heart and also pour out their joys and sufferings, and that this would be a lifelong way to live with Jesus and
yes.
their faith. So.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, the week of the year when heaven meets earth, and so lots of hearts can be changed and lots of minds can be changed. So, happy Holy Week to all of you. We will not be here next Monday, Easter Monday. We will be taking a church holiday, but we'll be back with you on Monday, April 8th. So we pray and hope that you have a blessed and, I don't even know what's
Triduum.
Triduum
and Easter.
Well, I'm just trying, you know, a really blessed but also joyful Triduum, and then
Easter week.
And just Easter week is, you know, you get into it what you put out of it. So
right.
if you've not been to confession yet, make a good confession this week. Go to the Holy Week services, and so far as your schedule will permit you to, and
yes.
you will not regret it. You'll
no.
never regret that. So, so we have, speaking of the church and all things Catholic today, we are so excited to be joined by author Bronwyn McShay, who is a historian. She's the author of three different books. She holds a doctorate from Yale and a master's degree from Harvard, so I'm already intimidated. But she's a very nice person, and she has a new book that is just hitting the shelves this week, probably a little too late for your Easter baskets, but a great gift for Mother's Day, I think.
I don't know. Amazon seems to be able to deliver everything.
Well, there you go.
In a couple hours.
There you go. And so we're really just, again, thrilled to be joined by author Bronwyn McShay. Bronwyn, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're really
we're
looking forward to this.
We're super excited, Bronwyn.
Yes.
You are one amazing woman.
Yeah, and this is one amazing book, really.
Thank you. I'm excited too. I actually just got some copies in the mail today.
I saw that on Twitter. So
yeah.
You can follow Bronwyn on Twitter as well, listeners, and learn how to get the book. But it's published by Ignatius Press. Well, first of all, tell us the title of the book and why you decided to write it.
So it's Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, and it's part of a series that's actually co-published by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute.
Okay.
And I decided to write the book partly in conversation with the Augustine Institute. I teach for them. I don't live in Denver, but I teach for the Augustine Institute, and I was asked to teach a course on the history of women in the church for the graduate students there. And I had already finished up a book, a biography of a rather remarkable Catholic woman, the niece of Cardinal Richelieu, Marie de Vignereau, who most Catholics don't know, but whose story was truly remarkable, and I thought more Catholics should know her. That's my last book called La Duchesse. And so anyway, things converged with this course, and then my work had been turning to the history of Catholic women, including those who I think people should know who maybe are not as well known.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so this book grew out of that sort of double track.
Now, before we go on, Bronwyn, can you tell our listeners who or what is the Augustine Institute?
The Augustine Institute is it's a multifaceted organization. I teach for the graduate school. They have sort of a publishing arm, and they also engage with parishes and kind of like the sort of popular audiences as well.
Sure.
So they're based in Denver. And
Ed Cerie and Tim Gray, are they out
Tim
of
Gray,
the Augustine? Yes.
Yes, Tim Gray is the president, and there's a wonderful faculty, primarily scripture scholars, theologians. I'm a historian with them. So I teach church history as part of a theology program for the graduate students. And
your book, La Duchesse, got the...
La Duchesse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you tell our listeners briefly what that was about and how it morphed into Women of the Church?
Sure. Well, La Duchesse, it has a very long subtitle, The Life of Marie de Vignereau, Cardinal Richelieu's Forgotten Heiress Who Shaped the Fate of France. Publishers like long titles these days. It's published by Pegasus Books in New York, so it's kind of a crossover book. It's very scholarly, but meant for ordinary readers as well. It's been reviewed in Wall Street Journal, New York Review of Books, etc. And it's a biography of a remarkable 17th century Catholic duchess, a French woman who I came across initially as a patroness of some of the early French missions in North America, because my first work was in that subject. And I started to find out all these remarkable things about her. She was involved as a literary patroness, artistic patroness. She was one of the main patrons of St. Vincent de Paul and the Congregation of the Mission. She was one of the first presidents of the Ladies of Charity. And she helped found entire missionary enterprises overseas, even though she never left France. She helped fund some of the first French missionary dioceses in Southeast Asia. She was kind of a mover and shaker in French politics and ecclesiastical life. And she wielded a lot more, I don't use the word power in the sense of competition with people, but she had a tremendous power in the French church as well as French political and cultural life beyond what I thought was possible for a non-royal woman of that time.
Right.
And she was a very devout Catholic. She had a very strong devotion to the Blessed Sacrament, et cetera, and this kind of animated her life in many ways, even though she had this very worldly career. So anyway, I was just fascinated by her as a historical figure who had been unbelievably, in my view, forgotten.
Right.
And I went to archives, et cetera, et cetera. So I got into the history of women through that project, and that's why I was asked to teach about the history of women in the church for the Augustines.
Bronwyn, on that sort of a related topic, have you read Willa Cather's Shadows on the Rock?
I haven't read it word for word terribly. I'm one of these people who loves nonfiction reading.
Right.
So
that's
but
a historical novel,
yes.
But also,
yes,
you know, yes. she goes into Maria of the Incarnation and,
yes.
you know, the early, it's about the first French colony in what they called New France at the time, but essentially it was the area around Montreal. But all of the, what's interesting, obviously, Willa Cather being a woman, is that she works in some of these people, these women who, you know, obviously a lot of the focus is and should be on the North American Jesuit martyrs and what they did, but a lot of the women who founded these religious orders to evangelize New France are worked in as well. So it's I just thought maybe your work had touched upon it or might have been influenced by it. It's one of my favorite books.
It's a wonderful novel. It was not, my work has not been directly influenced by that, but I was very glad to see how historically sensitive that book was, because some of the work I've been doing and other scholars has not necessarily filtered into sort of ordinary knowledge of the situation, but
right.
she seems to really know a lot. Like she seemed to have done a lot of her own investigating.
Yeah, and you know, she wasn't a Catholic. That's the part that always fascinates me, is that she's, you know, she writes the most, between that and Death Comes for the Archbishop, she's written two of the most beautiful and I think very laudatory books about the church, and she wasn't herself a Catholic. So anyway, but that's a topic for another.
Death Comes for the Archbishop is also a good novel. I did read that word for word.
Right. Shadows on the Rock is better, in my opinion.
Aside from the reading list that you may add to your next class, tell us how you chose to write the book Women of the Church, and how did you choose who to put in it?
Right. It was challenging. I mean, I partly was asked to consider writing a book of this nature, but I really wanted to, I mean, I'm trained as a scholar, but I'm also a cradle Catholic, and I have a lot of Catholic friends and family in my life who don't have the leisure to do deep dives into the 17th century with me as much as I wish they would. And I just, over the years, I just became cognizant of, not just the deeper stories of great saints that, you know, many of us are already familiar with, but maybe don't necessarily know how they fit into the historical context of their time, but also lesser-known saints, blesseds, even women who are not canonized and may never be, such as Isabella of Spain or Maria Theresa of Austria,
who
I think are just really important figures for the history of the church broadly. And I wanted to write a book that drew upon my expertise that I've been building up over many years, where I could actually just share this with ordinary readers, my fellow Catholics. So this is the first book I've written that's really intended for my fellow Catholics and not for a general public necessarily.
Did you have a favorite saint or story that came out of this book?
Well, there's so many. I actually initially I was imagining this book as maybe 25 chapters. Really focused on one particular woman in each, and then their times. And then as I was going along, I decided, no, what I wanted to do is actually kind of sort of tell the history of the church itself. It's broken down chronologically, not by figures. So it's very different from a traditional Lives of the Saints book. And I cover many women in each chapter, and I show how they fit into a larger story. So it's really kind of the history of the church through the stories and experiences of, I counted over 350 different women or groups of women from the patristic era to our own time. And there's several that really stood out to me. I mean, it's hard for me to zero in on any one of them. I've always had a special interest in Catherine of Siena because she was given to me as a patron saint. My middle name is Catherine.
Okay.
When I was a child, but I can never quite relate to her because she was, she liked to fast, number one. She had the nerve to go tell a pope what to do. I haven't yet, you know, had the nerve to do that. So I always liked her and fascinated by her, but I enjoyed writing about her as part of this historical time she lived in, as well as kind of emphasizing why she's a saint. And there are many surprises in the book as well. I was shocked to learn along the way that one of the early church councils, the Second Council of Nicaea in the 8th century, was actually called together by an empress, a Byzantine empress, Irene of Athens. And it was a normal thing for the Byzantine emperors, going back to Constantine, to convoke the early councils of the church. But for some reason, I had never heard that a woman was among these. She was actually reigning in the place of her son, who was he was sort of siding with the wrong side in the iconoclasm battle of the 8th century. And so that council settled the controversy that was really dividing the church over images. She was not necessarily a saintly woman. She sort of she knocked a few heads as empress,
right.
You know. But I thought she belonged in this book, and I tie her in a way I think that will surprise people. And there's many others. I can't even begin to say if I have a favorite. So
let me just go back to sort of your early days, Bronwyn, because you have your undergraduate and your master's degree from Harvard in. Mm-hmm. History, and then your PhD from Yale in history. How did you, choose that as the area that you wanted to study? Did you just always like history in high school? What sort of drove your interest in history overall?
Well, I was kind of weirdly obsessed with history even as a child. I loved films that took place in past times, and I would, you know, get books out of the library to see if things in favorite movies were true or not. So I just had kind of an interest in that growing up. My parents, very ordinary people. My dad, long-time New York City steam fitter, so working-class people, had tons of books in our house, including lots of history books. So I just grew up with it in the air.
Okay.
And so I knew I was going to major in history when I got to Harvard, but I thought I was going to become a lawyer. It was not sort of a conscious reality that I could become a professor, because I didn't know any professors till I got to Harvard. And I did have a few wonderful professors at Harvard who were actually Catholic themselves, who became friendly with me. And one of them encouraged me to think about graduate school when sort of the quality of my senior thesis was becoming apparent that I had some talent in that area. So I had some very good guidance, and I decided to do a master's in religious studies first at Harvard Divinity because I was not too sure yet what I wanted to do in graduate school. So I kind of bided my time a bit and studied the history of Christianity after college in a way that was not kind of committed to a doctoral course of study.
Got it. Okay. So, yeah, it's, you know, you're speaking to two lawyers here, of course, so we're glad, we're happy for you that you didn't choose that path.
There's more ways than one.
Friends are lawyers, and I'm always grateful I didn't become a lawyer. Forgive me, but
right now it's okay. Yeah,
we're
actually kind of envious of you. The looks we're exchanging with each other now. That you could have been us. We could have been you. Something like that. But I like that you went and you've combined studies of religion with your because the church is so steeped in history, obviously, and that you have a theological perspective with which to look at it is really interesting. I think that brings an aspect to your writing that I think not a lot of other authors wouldn't have.
I hope so. I mean, I don't consider myself a theologian. My theological studies at Harvard Divinity were not necessarily very, you know, Catholic theological side.
Right, but it doesn't come across that way, though, either. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you have, you know what you're writing about. You have more experience in the subject.
I did do, in grad school, and in, even in college, I was part of networks of Catholic friends in the Boston area and New Haven, and I did a lot of reading privately, you know, writings of John Henry Newman, various theologians that have shaped me, but that was both in class and outside of class. I did a lot of theological reading.
Yeah. Your work reflects it, because it doesn't read like just like a history book. It reads like, you know, I think it's accessible on a number of different levels, which is what I like about it so much. Well, Branwell, we're going to go to our first break. Sure. And when we come back, we'll delve a little more deeply into your new book, Women of the Church. Listeners, don't go away.
For 150 years, St. Stanislaus Koska Academy has been an oasis that builds a moral foundation for your child based upon Catholic faith, virtue, and valor, along with strong academic preparation for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Here's how you can help St. Stanislaus Koska Academy and have a good time. Come out and play for St. Stan's Academy during the annual Casino Night Fundraiser, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Enjoy casino games, food, drinks, and great music, all while helping to support St. Stanislaus Koska Academy, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Now, you must be 21 or over. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is located at 1255 North Noble in Chicago. That's one block north on Noble, off Division, just off the Kennedy. You are listening to
Mary Fiorito
and
Loretta Freilich
on Winds of Change. You can help save a life by praying for an end to abortion in your community. Find a 40 Days for Life vigil nearby. Visit 40daysforlife.com, 40daysforlife.com, to help save a life.
Welcome back. You're listening to Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich, and we are talking to Bronwyn McShay about her incredible background and her new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. Bronwyn, what was the thing that surprised you the most about your book, about the women that you studied to put in the church?
Sure. I think, there were several things. One of the things that surprised me the most, kind of as a thread that runs through the whole book, I went into this project, and I accomplished this. I wanted to cover all kinds of women.
Right.
As much as possible. So lay women, religious, more active, women from active congregations, wherever I could, mothers, sisters, members of families. I wanted like the full range that you can sort of document historically, and I wanted to represent lay women in a big way. As a lay woman myself, I thought that was important for a lot of readers. At the same time, though, I was kind of humbled and blown away by the legacy of consecrated women through time, and just what an anchor of the church they've been, and especially by the 19th century, just so many daring, interesting women who started new congregations that had, whether they were semi-contemplative, you know, with some contemplative and some active work, with schools, hospitals, missions, and then more active congregations. And some of these women were incredibly talented administrators and organizers and traveled to all sorts of places. I was humbled by the witness of women religious. I did not grow up with many around me. I heard stories from my parents, from their generation,
sure,
you know, of knowing many, many nuns who influenced them. And so, yeah, I think that was probably the most globally surprising thing in writing the book. They kind of called to me to speak about them even more than I was planning to.
Now, did you include Saint Mother Mary Cabrini by any chance?
I do, briefly. I don't go into her at great length, but I certainly do discuss her. Mm-hmm.
And what did you find that surprised you the most? Like, was there one character trait or was it their faith in God? What is it that you saw that brought these women to the top of the pile?
Well, Mother Cabrini in particular, and wonderfully, actually, I visited her shrine here in New York. My sister-in-law had a group of Catholic moms, well-read moms. They came down and visited the shrine, and I joined them. And so I visited her shrine before I finished the part in the book about her. Mm. And she was not just persistent in sort of following the light. She felt, you know, God was calling her to do particular right. missionary sort of work. Not necessarily in the location she ended up in.
No.
She wanted to go to Asia,
right?
Not New York, but her tremendous courage in doing that and just sort of sticking to that. But also, maybe this seems like I don't know. I don't want to reduce her to this. She had a tremendous fear of water.
Yes,
she had this drowning incident. She almost drowned. She was young. She hated boat travel. She crossed the Atlantic Ocean. And went also down to Latin America a few times, so many times. Like, she faced this continuous fear of boat travel. And I just, something so human in that regard, and that she just sort of, you know, went through that and achieved this international missionary congregation. And there were others like her. She was actually not the first woman of the 19th century to start a missionary congregation. I talk about a number of others in the book. And there were many people who kind of, had that kind of just courage of conviction and sense of following God's mission that they're asking them to do for Him, even despite some difficulty along the way, whether from this or that figure in authority or just something going wrong with their health
sure.
or something.
Well, you know, Brown, I know that New York has a shrine to Mother Cabrini, but you know, she died here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the room where Mother died, and in fact, the little boy who was her miracle, the miracle for her canonization, you know, was a little boy who was born at Columbus Hospital, mm-hmm. Whose prayers to her, his sight was mm-hmm. restored, and then he became a Catholic priest. But Loretta's grandma used to drive Mother Cabrini to her doctor's appointments. So how about that?
Oh, my gosh, really?
Yeah, yes. Can you believe that? So, like, Loretta's like a third-class relic or something.
I am.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So there
that
you go. So you're
cool.
being interviewed about Mother Cabrini by a third-class relic of Mother Cabrini herself. So I just felt that I pointed
amazing.
That out to you before Loretta pointed out to you herself.
I'm glad to mention that. And the Chicago, sorry, go ahead. Oh,
yeah, so I just think, too, with the movie, it's so New York-centric about Mother, when actually the second half of her life really was in Chicago. And so, you know, we're the second city in all sorts of different ways. But some of us were a little bit put out by that lack of sharing about Mother. Yeah, so anyway.
I'm from New York. I'm from New York. I always thought of her as a very New York thing.
Yeah,
and that was actually one of the surprising things, that she was... she and the congregation were active in many other parts of the U.S.
Yes.
and also beyond the United States.
Right.
So I feel like the movie has some great things about
sure.
it, but it really, it's just a slice of her remarkable life.
Yes.
Right.
Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the movie yet. At the very end, when the newspaper reporter is telling, you know, the conclusion, and he's, you know, talking about how Mother went on to do all these other things, and you see the lines connecting from New York to the other place she went on mission, you are cheering for China to be on that page, because that was how she wanted to start, and so, you know, and then you're right, there was just so many amazing things that she did, the shrine here in Chicago has her cell. And so you can go and see where Mother lived very simply and humbly. And yet God did such great things through her for love of His people. And it was really beautiful.
Yeah. Amazing.
And, you know, it was what I thought was helpful. I'm not Italian myself, but I am married to one. And so I have half Italian children. But for people to understand... every immigrant group here has been treated with some level of disdain and rejection, I would argue. But the Italians in particular were really subject to just disgraceful conditions and abuse. And in fact, the largest mass lynching in U.S. history was not of black men. It was of Italian men. 11 Italian men in New Orleans. So the movie doesn't touch upon that, obviously, but... It was good, I think, for my youngest daughter just went to see it and with her class at school. And I was so grateful that it exposed her because, you know, now we live in a world where, you know, unfortunately, usually we treat ethnic groups and we respect the differences that they bring, et cetera, but that wasn't always the case. And you don't ever think of Italians of being in that, you know,
right?
Because Italians are sort of beloved now because they're for their food, but nothing else. But, you know, Brian, what I like about mm-hmm. this is that you have a section of your book about what you call the social witness of Catholic women. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you just spend any amount of time, you know, as a penance on Twitter or even on Facebook, so many women, particular, I would say women in kind of the 30 to 40 year old cohort, who are still mm-hmm. so locked into this women can't be priests, and so therefore women are not equal narrative. And,
right.
And you know, that's, again, that entire theological discussion is for another day, and it's not the basis of your book.
Sure. Right.
How did you, what I like about your book, though, is that, you know, you're bringing forth all these women, whether they are nobility or saints or, you know, mm-hmm. Whatever, ordinary lay people who had such a revolutionary impact on society. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how you wrote about them without bumping up against that priesthood question.
Well, I didn't entirely avoid it altogether because there were a few early church examples of women who are described as deacons,
right?
Which is not priesthood, but I know that there's a question about
right.
women in the diaconate. I just looked at some of the scholarly work that's on that subject, and I didn't see much evidence of in the scholarly works I consulted that anything like an ordained diaconate was that women were part of
in
the early days. The
right.
word deacon was often used for a woman who was a widow and of noble stature, and so she was given a special title if she joined a religious congregation of otherwise virgins who were with her.
Yes.
And she maybe had some sort of status. So, that's not an area I'm an expert. There are other scholars who can speak to that. But I get a bit frustrated at this women in the priesthood question because it, to me, it comes from a clericalized understanding of the church. The
mm-hmm.
church is not the clergy. And the church is the people of God, and the clergy are a small group without whom, as John Henry Newman said, that without the laity, they would look rather silly, right?
So, right.
John Henry Newman said something a little more eloquently than that. But I think, like, priestly ordination, the priesthood is so important, it's so central, and the sacramental ministry of priests is so central, but women have this other thing called motherhood, whether spiritual motherhood or actual motherhood, which is a kind of power that, unlike anything men have any access to, although we have people trying to change that scientifically these days.
But right.
Those, to me, that's the sort of the opposite side of this kind of obsession with trying to get women to be priests.
Yes.
I think some of this, the gender-bending stuff that we see is sort of related spiritually in some way. I just feel like it's... our understanding of the church needs to be more encompassing. I think we use phrases that imply that we see the church more broadly as kind of the body of the faithful through time.
Yeah.
You know, led sacramentally by the clergy. But when we focus in on things like women's ordination, we're just sort of giving into that clericalism that is... just to me, a very modern phenomenon that's kind of strange to me and unhelpful to anybody, and unhelpful to our priests, frankly, because they exist to be in a complementary relationship
yes.
with the rest of the church, right?
Yes.
And so well, they feel like that somehow it just burdens them with a strange perception of what they're about, and a weird guilt in some cases.
But it's also, without the priest, we couldn't live our lives the way we love them.
Mm-hmm,
but that
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that it's the exclusive opportunity to serve mm-hmm. in the church.
And right, right.
And so we take what they bring, you know, for us and bring mm-hmm. Jesus to us, but, you know, they can't do it alone. And
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
they can't, you know, I mean, one of the things that I find myself doing is, I'm the sacristan for daily mass.
Mm-hmm.
Setting that up lets Father deal with other stuff as he, homily, the people he's praying for, and lets that flow more naturally than running around putting unconsecrated hosts in the ciborium. So I find that that's a blessing that somebody who's organized, male or female, can do, but it frees them up to do that which they have been ordained for.
Yeah. Right. And there's kind of a, if I could jump in again.
Sure.
There was a very healthy sense in the centuries leading up to the 19th century, I would say, but it seemed to have disappeared in the 19th and certainly by the 20th century, that the nave of the church, most of the space of the church, not the altar, but the nave, was the laity's domain. And that, you know, with the furniture and the decorations and just keeping it tidy, and like that was their space.
Right.
You know, and
interesting.
The clergy had the altar,
right,
and there were certain different kind of different orders in that, in both spaces. And there were plenty of women over time, including my favorite Duchess of Aiguillon, who in their spheres, in the more secular sphere of the church, I think that in the old days it's easier to see because you have church-state marriages, so like you can speak of the secular side of the church separate from kind of the sanctuary, right? Outside the sanctuary, it's the whole world, in a way, was the church outside the sanctuary. There were plenty of very powerful women who told many priests and bishops and occasionally even popes what to do. And they had no sense that this was not in keeping with their Catholic fidelity to the church. I think in the 19th, 20th centuries, various things happened that a certain imbalance was introduced. And so we see ourselves as below the clergy in every way, in some way. And that was just not the case before modern times, ironically. So, I think because maybe society itself, I'm not advocating for aristocratic hierarchies,
but when
you have a robust aristocratic hierarchy outside the clergy, it's easier for, there was kind of a parity there, whereas like the clergy today it's hierarchical, but we do not consider the rest of the church hierarchical in any way, it's a complicated matter, and I don't want to say anything.
I don't mean to, you know, get off on a tangent. It's just that I'm wondering, though, you know, as you're doing your book tour now and as you're talking to people and doing interviews, do you find that this is coming up as sort of the default question among people who might?
Not yet.
Okay.
No, not yet.
See, I'm getting you ready.
This is your dry run
for the question, Bronwyn.
I've given a few talks, but that has not come up very much yet. So,
Bronwyn, what's the one thing you wish readers would take away from this book?
Well, it's kind of something I say in the book, and Ignatius decided to use it in sort of billing the book, that the history of Catholic women is not a kind of marginal subject tacked onto the side of the history of the church. The history of the women of the church is the history of the church as much as the history of Catholic men is, and that I want them to sort of read, like, through the stories of these women, sort of see the church herself with fresh eyes, you know, and see maybe their own place within the church and the possibilities that might be open to them, maybe not immediately apparent given their circumstances, but just to be open to what God might be asking of people through the witness of these remarkable women, saintly and occasionally otherwise, but
maybe a group of characters for sure.
Is there any chance that there's kind of a study that would be coming out of this, or a class that could be taken online?
I haven't spoken to anyone yet about that, but I'll certainly be, you know, seeing what might be possible.
I think it would make a wonderful women's study, and men could take it too. But I really think right now, so many things seem to be happening with all the feuding that's going on in the church and everybody siding up. And okay, guys, let's talk about some of these women that did some amazing things. And it would be a marvelous, I don't want to call it a Bible study, but it would be a marvelous book for people, women especially, to read and see, you know, how they are at the heart of the church and that this is, you know, this is incredible women that have promoted evangelization and the love of the church they have in their hearts that has moved it forward.
And also struggled with things within the church while remaining faithful and struggling with things in society. And so it's not like a, you know, many of these women went through, they suffered for what they did sometimes, and they triumphed in different ways. And
right.
I certainly wouldn't mind it if book clubs, et cetera, want to, you know, get copies of my book and have discussions. And I'd be happy to talk to groups. So I'm happy to receive invitations.
Well, that's terrific.
Anyone listening.
Yeah, and so, I hope that this interview leads to some of those. And because I think particularly all girls' schools could benefit from hearing you. And so that leads me to my next question is, do you think that there's anything in this book for non-Catholics? So, if, say, a Christian women's group is listening to this, and we do have quite a few Christian listeners who aren't Catholic. What does your book offer to them?
I mean, it's certainly, I think women are interested in the history of women. The history of Catholic women is a large chunk of the history of women.
Well, there you go.
In our times and past times.
And certainly of Europe.
And I think, I get into some difficult moments for the Catholic Church, including the Reformation, the French Revolutionary period. And I have friends who are not Catholic who seem interested in what I'm doing here. And
what's piquing their interest?
So
what is it that you think they're...
I think it has to do with the sense that some of the women covered in here have not gotten the kind of press that they might have deserved over time. And that I'm trying to bring certain people to light who more Catholics should know as well as others. I think they just appreciate that as a general project.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And,
sure.
And they're just curious to know. You know, and there are occasionally people who are not Catholic who are curious about Catholicism, and reading the history of the Church is a little less... it's different than reading Catholic apologetics or theology. Mm-hmm. This book is not trying to convince anyone to become a Catholic, but it does explain who Catholics are. And so I think in a way that's inviting to some non-Catholic readers.
You know, right. It's just a very straightforward, it's a history book, but with someone who understands theology, which is what makes it, I think, sort of unique among the kind of work. And you go into people, women like Julia Greeley, for example, who, is so, even in this day and age, not as well known as she should be, somebody... who was a philanthropist and did so much for the Black community. And, and we could go, sort of on and on. But I do love that you include Edith Stein in here, because she is someone who, of course, is a convert from the Jewish. Well, actually, she was Jewish, but then she was basically an agnostic or an atheist until she became a Catholic and became a Carmelite. She's somewhat well known because, of course, she died in Auschwitz. And even among the Jewish community, I think she is respected as a person who gave her life for her her Jewish brothers and sisters, actually, even though she was a Catholic. Just so many just inspirational women from all of these. But, I want to go back just to the title of your book that, that you believe that these are women everyone should know. Why, just more broadly, why these women, and why do people need to know who they are?
I think, the series, the subtitle, What Every Catholic Should Know, every book in the series has that subtitle.
Right,
so that was sort of the guiding rubric that I had in deciding who to include in this book. A few of my colleagues at the Augustine Institute have contributed to this series and there are different subjects. But I think I wanted women of the church, not necessarily in the church, because some of them, I think, I want to show how they're formed by the church and then they affect society beyond the church. Some of them are not always, like historical figures who are not necessarily saintly, but I think every Catholic should know as important to their Catholic heritage. Someone like Isabella of Castile, she's sort of a giant figure in the history of the church in the Renaissance period. And so I feel like Catholics in general are not terribly well educated about the history of their church outside of a few certain eras that we cover a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tremendous heritage that we have, and I think, and women are obviously a half of that heritage.
Right.
And I just think, for the sake of understanding who we are as a church going back through the centuries to the time of Christ, that these are the ones that I thought I should highlight that illustrate the role that women have played in many different ways in building the church and witnessing for the church. And so
So now I know that you have your own copies, your very own, but where can our listeners, where's the best place for them to purchase this book? And is it going to be available in an audio format? Are you going to be on a speaking tour? How can listeners, if they want to learn a little more?
I was actually in Chicago just the other day at Lumen Christi.
I wish I had known that. I had to stalk you on social media to find that out.
I was also at another conference, so I was really kind of tied up in other ways. And I'm kicking myself I didn't visit the Cabrini Shrine.
Yeah, did you get an Italian beef? Did they take you for a proper beef?
I had, say it again, sorry.
Did you go for an Italian beef? Did they treat you properly?
No.
I had deep dish pizza, though, I saw on Twitter. Okay, that's acceptable. But next time, Loretta and I will treat you properly and take you for a real Italian beef.
Already figuring out how to get her. What kind of group you'd like to come to talk about this?
Well, that's a good question, Loretta.
What kind of group would you recommend you would speak to well?
I mean, a parish group could work, or, you know, if there's a women's group, obviously. Women's group. Yeah, I've spoken to a few women's groups already, including related to my last book. So I'm really open. So if ideas occur to people, I'm happy to discuss possibilities. So you asked where the book can be purchased.
Yes, please. Where's the best place to get them?
So far, it seems like the speediest delivery comes from Catholic.market, which is the Gelson Institute's storefront, Catholic.market.
Okay.
And, or Ignatius.com.
Right, Ignatius Press, Ignatius.com.
They have the paperback. Right. They have the paperback, not the hardcover, so depending on what people want.
Sure.
The paperbacks are nice and light. They fit in a purse easily.
Okay.
So you can also, people don't like promoting Amazon, but they can be pre-ordered on Amazon. I think Barnes & Noble has them. Available for pre-order, and different sites.
Okay.
Can I ask you, Bronwyn, what's next for you? I'm dying to read your last two books, but what's next? A third book or a fourth book coming?
Yeah, so I did write another book on the history of Jesuit missionaries. It was the first book, and there were women in that story too. That's sort of led me to the Duchess of Aiguillon. But I think I want to do my next book. I'm debating between two ideas, and I'm not really ready to kind of.
Okay, no worries.
Describe, but one of the ideas is a possible biography of another woman, but the other idea is more of a history of a certain group of Catholics over time that would not be about women per se, but women would be sort of amply represented in the way that I like to do when I tell the history of the church. So
I'm hoping for you that the History Channel or someplace equally prestigious will pick this up, because it's such an important contribution, and women, you know, who were also religious should not be written off in history as if, you know, somehow their contributions were doesn't merit the attention of, you know, Betsy Ross or whatever other historical figure you want to pull out of the sky. Well, Bronwyn, thank you so much for giving us so much time today. Good luck with the book. And listeners, we'll put those links to where you can buy Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. We'll put those in the show notes. Bronwyn, have a great week. And happy Easter to you.
Yes, Bronwyn.
Thank you so much. Happy Easter.
God bless.
Thank you so much,
Bronwyn. And listeners, please don't go away. We'll come
My
back.
Pleasure.
We'll be wrapping up the show after the break. Don't go away.
For 150 years, St. Stanislaus Koska Academy has been an oasis that builds a moral foundation for your child based upon Catholic faith, virtue, and valor, along with strong academic preparation for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. Here's how you can help St. Stanislaus Koska Academy and have a good time. Come out and play for St. Stan's Academy during the annual Casino Night Fundraiser, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Enjoy casino games, food, drinks, and great music, all while helping to support St. Stanislaus Koska Academy, Saturday, April 25th at 6 p.m. Now, you must be 21 or over. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is located at 1255 North Noble in Chicago. That's one block north on Noble, off Division, just off the Kennedy.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Koska Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool age 3 and 4
pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we wanted to leave a little bit of time in the show today because tomorrow is going to be a big day for those of you who follow abortion jurisprudence and abortion law, because the Supreme Court of the United States is going to hear oral arguments on limits on the abortion pill mifepristone, so sometimes called RU486. They're going to be hearing arguments about whether or not they should leave the current regulations, which are basically no regulations surrounding the dispensement of dispensing, I guess, of abortion pills, and or to go back to the protocols that were in place in 2016, or you know, to really take a look at the safety record and the method by which these abortion pills were approved. And I have a very lengthy article at our Sunday Visitor. If you go to our sundayvisitor.com, where I go through the entire history of the approval of the abortion pill and how it a particular loophole was used in the FDA's approval process called Subpart H, which up until then had been used only in cases of extreme emergencies. For example, a malaria drug, a special kind of drug to treat cancer. It was used during the AIDS epidemic for any kind of drug that might somehow address the AIDS illness. So the Clinton administration in their waning days pressured the FDA into approving mifepristone under this subpart H protocol, which it never should have been. And then you can kind of fast forward. The company, by the way, Danco Laboratories, that produces and distributes mifepristone, does not produce or distribute any other drug. This is the only drug that they manufacture and the only drug that they distribute. So right there, that should give this. So this is not kind of a mainstream pharmaceutical company. This is all they make. This is all they distribute. It's a company that's really shrouded in secrecy. No one knows where it's located. No one knows who the board of directors are. They don't disclose their profits every year. And unfortunately, due to the pandemic, even in-person doctor visits, which were strongly recommended at the time the drug was approved, were tossed aside, and now the gestational age was increased to 10 weeks from 7 weeks with no doctor visit prior. Any woman who's experiencing, for example, an ectopic pregnancy and doesn't know she's experiencing an ectopic pregnancy can hemorrhage to death if she takes the abortion pill. It can be very, very dangerous for a woman in that predicament. But now you can just obtain it by telehealth. You can obtain it over the by the mail. We have already seen multiple cases now of men obtaining abortion pills through the mail and then slipping them into the drinks or the food of unsuspecting women who they have impregnated and they don't want pregnant any longer. We've seen that done. Two doctors and a nurse, a male nurse, have done that. So the potential for abuse and misuse of these pills is significant. The abortion industry and the abortion lobby will tell you it's just as safe as taking a Tylenol. That could not be further from the truth. If you are a person taking this pill, a woman taking this pill, you have a 1 in 25 chance of winding up in the emergency room, either with hemorrhaging or retained fetal body parts. And if you want, I think probably the most recent and most heartbreaking example of someone who suffered after taking this pill is Britney Spears, of all people. She revealed in her autobiography that came out a couple of months ago, The Woman in Me, that she, that Justin Timberlake had gotten her pregnant while they were dating, that he did not want the child. She said she would have done anything to keep that baby, but he pressured her. She did not want to be seen in an abortion. Well, more
he didn't want her to be seen in an abortion clinic, so they got abortion pills. And she talks about how it was the most excruciating experience she'd ever had. To this day, she wishes she had not done it. It's really very, very sad. And, you know, a lot of people wonder why she has the kind of mental health problems that she does. And, you know, she came face to face with the remains of her unborn child and then had to dispose of her unborn child's body down the toilet. Now, you know, we know already that women who are even very healthy mentally have very bad experience with depression and anxiety, et cetera, after having abortion. And could you imagine if you have even a minimal mental health issue and then you go through this? So I don't know enough about her particular circumstances to say the abortion had everything to do with it. But, boy, you read through that and it certainly has something to do with it because, she speaks about her pregnancy with her two sons that she has and about how she thought, you know, I'm going to be their protector. No one is going to, while she was pregnant, she never felt stronger because she knew she was protecting those children. It's really heartbreaking. I do think she is a classic example of someone suffering from post-abortion aftermath. But at any rate, so the Supreme Court is going to be hearing oral arguments beginning at 9 a.m. Chicago time, 10 a.m. Eastern time tomorrow. So first of all, if you would pray for that, that the justices will be open to the arguments that are being made, not necessarily on behalf of the unborn, but in this case, really on behalf of vulnerable women. And we've already seen cases, you know, where, for example, the case in Nebraska where a mom purchased abortion pills for her daughter who was 29 and a half weeks pregnant. That was a viable baby, but she got these abortion pills through the mail, gave them to her daughter. Her daughter gave birth to a stillborn in the shower.
Oh.
They attempted to incinerate the baby's body in a Weber grill. When that didn't work, they took the baby's body out to a field and buried it. And they were both charged with mishandling a corpse. But that's, you know, her daughter could have hemorrhaged to death from taking those abortion pills so late in pregnancy. So there's, again, rife for abuse and misuse, not really serving any kind of medical purpose for women, a company that's shrouded in secrecy, and an approval process that wouldn't have happened with any other kind of drug in the way that it did. So a lot to pray for and to listen to tomorrow morning. I'm going to be speaking at a press conference being held after the oral arguments at the headquarters of Walgreens in Deerfield, Illinois. There will be a group of pro-life activists and pro-life advocates who will be there speaking to the press. And because Walgreens is now going to be distributing this pill in all of its pharmacies, and I believe CVS is going to be distributing them at least some of their pharmacies. So that's very, you know, you go to a Walgreens or CVS to get better from illnesses, not to take the life of an unborn child.
And Mary, you mentioned a very important point that, you know, the arguments will be presented before the justices. And what most people don't know about Roe v. Wade is that when both sides came to the Supreme Court for the first argument in Roe v. Wade, the justices sent them home and said, you're not prepared to argue this. This is not ready for your arguments before us. And so come back at this time.
Right.
So we want to, and then the pro-aborts, they prepared during that time. The pro-lifers did not.
Yeah.
So please pray that all those that are speaking against this before the Supreme Court will be gifted with all the charisms of the Holy Spirit. Pray that Mary is blessed in her remarks and that anyone that is fighting for life be filled with the Holy Spirit and that the justices' hearts are turned.
Yes, amen. Amen. And that women are protected from a dangerous drug that they're shamed into being silent about if they've used it. So, listeners, as I mentioned at the outset of the show, we will not be in for a live show next week. We are going to be observing Easter Monday with our families, but we pray that you again will have a very beautiful and holy, holy week, and the Triduum will be of great benefit to you spiritually, and that you will have a joyous and happy Easter. God bless you. Have a great week.
The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time.